The Evolve with Pete Evans podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. I love exploring the topics that are not traditionally taught at school and take a deep dive into them with my special guests. I invite you to sit back and come along for the ride with an open mind and heart, and please share with your family and friends, as these podcasts may just be the seed from which many things will flourish from. Cheers. We've been using Waters Co. water filters for the last 10 years, and I wholeheartedly trust my family's health with them. Waters Co., established 1977, have personal and domestic water filters, which turns your ordinary tap water into great-tasting, alkaline, ionized mineral water, which removes up to 99.9% of fluoride, heavy metals, chemicals, and bacteria, so you can love your tap water again. The Bio 1000 is the latest edition of the BMP 1000 model and the culmination of over 40 years of experience and research into water filtration by some of the world's leading scientists. Waters Co. was first to market with natural gravity-fed systems, creating alkaline water way back in 1984, and have continued to lead the market in research and development, setting the benchmark for all other brands to follow. Please go to my webpage, PeteEvans.com, to learn more and to receive your special discount from my link on the products page. You're going to love it. John Adams is an independent economic analyst and commentator, having written on economic, political, cultural, and public policy matters for a variety of news outlets, including news.com.au, The Daily Telegraph, The Spectator Australia, The Canberra Times, and The Australian Business Executive. Among John's various current roles, John is the chief economist at Good as Gold Australia, an Adelaide-based gold and silver dealership, where he regularly contributes fresh insights and analysis on the Australian and global economy. To find out more about John Adams, please visit his website, adamseconomics.com. That's adamseconomics.com. John, thank you so much for joining us. How are you, brother?
Good, mate. How are you going today?
Mate, really, really good. Thanks for joining us once again. I feel like we're getting to know each other and form a great relationship here.
Cool. Yeah. So, I mean, look, I've got to say, the last time when we spoke, you were we were mainly talking about the economy, but now you've announced your candidacy to run for the Senate, and now you're into the full political fray.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I was looking for other people to do this, to be honest with you. And even last year, I spoke with Alan Jones, the journalist with Sky News. And I said, who in Australia is there that can basically pave the way forward or is fighting for Australians? And he said, no one. And that really resonated deeply within me, for somebody to say there's actually no one in the political arena that can take us forward. And I'd like to get your understanding on this, because I know you have just recently sent a pretty firm letter to the government stating many, many things that need addressing and need answers. And yeah, so I'm going to hand it over to you, John, and I would love to have your understanding, perception of the Australian government at the moment. And last time we chatted, for anybody that is interested, we went right into the economic situation and disaster that we seem to be facing. And I shouldn't laugh, but fuck, sometimes that's all we can do. So tell me about the Australian political system as you see it, and why you wrote that powerful letter in the last week to the government.
Sure, yeah. Yes. So last December, within the federal parliament, there's a committee called the parliamentary joint committee on intelligence and security, and basically all of the secret spies in the government, they're the ones that they go answer to this committee. So it's a pretty important committee, and they started an inquiry in December talking about extremist movements and radicalization. And one of the origins for this is some testimony that ASIO gave to the Senate back in September last year. And they basically said that what we are witnessing in Australia is an explosion of so-called far-right extremism that's manifesting itself across the country. Now, since 9/11, ASIO, with its counterterrorism work, has been focused on domestic Islamic terrorism, which is heavily concentrated in Sydney, Melbourne, and a touch in Brisbane. But what they're now saying is that there's a whole bunch of young white Australians, late teens, early 20s, who are pissed off with the government, and they're getting on social media, and they're actually talking in ways which is threatening to the establishment. Now, obviously, some in the establishment are using Christchurch as a they're using that as an example of when white extremism gets out of control, you're going to get people, you know, using firearms and shooting a whole bunch of innocent people. So I would say I haven't seen any direct evidence of white Australian terrorism in Australia. And I'm really interested to unpack this whole notion that there's been an explosion of these people on the internet who are talking in violent terms about taking down the system. Now, back in 2016, ASIO's about 10 to 15% of its caseload, anti-terrorism caseload, was looking at this far-right extremism. Now they're saying it's between 30 to 40% as of last year, and that certain groups on the internet have taken advantage of COVID-19 to push conspiracy theories, disinformation, you know, whatever the establishment don't want to hear. And so obviously when it comes to the economy and when it comes to certain elements of politics, I mean, I've been out there for several years talking a very different tune to what the government and the banks and the mainstream media are saying. And obviously, particularly in terms of your area of expertise around health, and I know you've been very active about COVID-19 in terms of vaccines. I mean, you're saying something very different. And, you know, look, maybe it's every week, every fortnight, the mainstream media is saying something new about Pete Evans. He's a conspiracy theorist. He's pushing disinformation. You had Craig Kelly on, and now he's been banned from Facebook for a week because he was citing peer-reviewed medical journal articles. Look, the whole thing's completely ridiculous. So the big concern I have with this whole issue, and I should just say that Senator Christine Keneally, the former Premier of New South Wales, who's now in the Australian Senate, she was pushing for this inquiry. She's been pushing this really, really hard. And the government cut a deal with Labor last year where Labor gave the government something, and in exchange they got this inquiry. So from December to Friday last week, the 12th of February, there was the opportunity to put in submissions to the inquiry. And I thought, oh, well, I can't let this opportunity slip, because what I suspect is going to happen is the government and ASIO and the opposition, they're going to insist on a power grab. So they're going to say that there's a whole bunch of people out there who's pushing crazy ideas. They're influencing people. People are getting radicalized, and we need to put a stop to it. And there's obviously, I mean, look, it's people like you, it's people like me, it's people like Max Egan, a whole bunch of people who just don't accept what we're being told by the establishment, by the media, about a whole host of subjects, whether it's about COVID-19, whether it's about the US election, whether it's about the economy or child sex abuse, all sorts of things out there that the real story is very different it's very different to what we're being told. So I decided to put in a submission, I made a number of points in the submission. So I'll give you a bit of a high level view. So the first thing I said was, just because you have a very different political opinion and you have some very controversial opinions, that doesn't mean you should be subject to government surveillance. So if people are on the internet saying that they are against vaccines, if they're against immigration policy, if they're against the banks or whatever the case may be, that shouldn't be subject to surveillance in terms of ASIO. And, you know, we really don't know what the threshold is for the government to spy on people. Because obviously they're saying that there's an explosion of white terrorism or white extremism in Australia. So what is it that white Australians are saying that's actually driving in an increase in government surveillance? And it's interesting that they talk about far right extremism, but far left extremism like Antifa, like Black Lives Matter, like other groups which actually do use violence tactics to make their political point, they seem to be not on the radar of our intelligence services. So the first thing I say is, If people have a controversial opinion, no matter what their ethnic background is, people have the right to engage in politics and express controversial opinions without being spied on by the government. And I don't want left-wing academics. There was a study by Macquarie University that was published in October, and they basically say that there's a whole bunch of far right-wing people who have non-mainstream opinions who are talking on the internet, and this group of people are now dangerous. And obviously, you've been banned from social media, and I've had some issues with social media as well. So no doubt, Macquarie University are probably referring to people like you and me. So if you and me want to have a chat, if we want to say the government's corrupt, if we want to say that there's a whole bunch of issues that the government is not addressing, we should have the freedom to do that without being subject to ASIO surveillance. So that's probably point one. The second point I made was that this issue of violence against the government. Now, under federal Australian law, any discussion of violence, any urging of violence, any performance of violence against the government is completely illegal and is subject to criminal prosecution. Now, in the main, I actually agree with that point, because obviously I want a peaceful and a stable social society. But one of the key points I made was that 200 years ago, there was a very different idea floating around, and this was expressed by Thomas Jefferson in the U.S. Declaration of Independence, and that was that we have rights that come from, you know, God or from a universal power, wherever humanity came from. And those rights predate government, they predate parliament, and those rights can't be taken away from the government. They can't be taken away by the government. So if we ever got into a situation, maybe like Victoria with Daniel Andrews, where the government's out of control, And people's ability to think, to speak, to assemble, to protest, to live the life that they wish to live, to believe in the religion that they so choose. If some of those freedoms are taken away by the government, Jefferson said that the people have the freedom to, quote, alter or abolish the government. Now, when he wrote that in 1776, he was talking about violence, because they just declared independence from the UK, and they said they were going to institute a revolution against the United Kingdom. So now that idea about using violence to defend your rights, I mean, that is a it's not just an American idea. It actually has very deep roots in terms of Western Europe. I mean, for example, King Charles I, when he was executed after the English Civil War, the crime he was charged with was treason against the people. Well, when you actually look at Commonwealth law, there is no treason against the people. There's treason against the Queen, there's treason against the Queen's representative, which is the Governor General, and there's treason against the Prime Minister. But if the government engages in treason against us, well, that is acceptable. So pretty much I'm saying is that one is, I say in my submission, if Thomas Jefferson was alive today, the mainstream media and the government and ASIO probably would say Thomas Jefferson is a right-wing extremist. And that, I think, is wrong. One of my recommendations is for the government to explicitly say Thomas Jefferson is not a far-right extremist because he advocated violence against the government. So now the other thing I said was, I think, so the Australian Constitution and federal law doesn't say anything about Australians having natural rights. So we don't have a Bill of Rights. We don't have any articulation that we have certain rights. Now, the only thing we can really draw on is the history of England and in terms of British law, English customs, because those customs still have relevance to our legal and constitutional system today. So I have asked the Parliament and this committee to make an explicit statement about whether we do have natural rights, and whether we have the ability to use violence to defend those rights if the government ever got out of control. There's a whole host of Australians who believe we do have natural rights and we do have the ability, for example, in Ballarat in 1854, I mean, they took up weapons against the government because Governor Hotham and the Victorian police were out of control trying to enforce all of these laws around gold mining licenses. And then there was a famous murder, and the courts were rigged, and the miners just had enough, and they took up weapons, and they got slaughtered in 20 minutes. But But because of that confrontation at the Eureka Stockade, that led to a number of important reforms in Victoria's political system. And one thing that Australians don't actually understand is when we go on election day and we can vote in secret, that was first instituted in Victoria in the late 1850s or in the early 1860s. So before Ballarat, there was no secret ballot anywhere in the world. In England, you had to basically vote by going down to the local pub and actually putting your hand up in front of your whole community. And there was a whole bunch of tactics around intimidation, and same thing here in the United States. So Australia's greatest gift to the world is the secret ballot. It is the universal standard for democratic elections. And, you know, more than 30 people had to die in order for that to be established. So using violence against government in the most extreme of extreme circumstances is just. I do think there are benefits to that. And I think it is important that the government recognises that proposition. Now, because the main point is that the law, the way current federal law is written, it doesn't recognise that. And I think there's a lot of Australians who have the assumption that we have rights, and we have the assumption that we can use violence if the circumstances permit it. But I think what we're going to flesh out in this inquiry is to, well, what is the real position? Are we free or are we slaves? And that, I think, is an important point. Now, in this question about do we have an explosion of extremism, the point I've made is that, well, why? I mean, if there are more young white Australians on the internet talking in a more extremist or flamboyant manner about the government, why would that be? And one of the big things I cite is that there is a whole host of statistics that was published in 2019, so less than 18 months ago, that basically said that trust in our political and civic institutions have collapsed. So there was, I think, the Australian election survey that was done by the Australian National University around the time of the 2019 election. And the basically, you know, trust in democracy, trust in our political leaders, it was at an all-time low. So people have, and a lot of this happened since John Howard left. So the quality of our political leadership, whether it's Rod Gillard, Abbott, Turnbull, Morrison, people just don't have trust that our politicians are actually doing a good job and they're actually acting in the best interest of the country. The other thing I would also point is that, I mean, on a whole host of objective metrics, I mean, Australia is in decline. A lot of politicians like to be cute and say we're the greatest country in the world, but no, we're actually going backwards. So compared to 20 years ago, we are, you know, in terms of on an individual basis, we are in greater debt, we are under more financial pressure, we are fatter, we are more depressed, we're more hooked on drugs with a prescription on narcotics, and our children's ability to get good education results or education attainment results has collapsed. You know, when you look at the what they call the PISA scores, which is sort of this international scoring system, we peaked in 1999 and maths, English and science, our results have gone backwards, even though spending on education, you know, it is at an all-time high. So we are going backwards. Our political leaders they're not governing Australia in the right way. And obviously you expressed frustration. That's why you had a chat with Alan Jones, and I'm frustrated with the state of where the country is going as well. And the important other thing is that this is not just a Australian phenomena. So across the OECD, which includes, I think, more than 25 countries, in 2019, we also saw a huge collapse in trust in judges, courts, politicians, parliaments, banks, etc. So we are seeing a global phenomena of people waking up to what is really going on. They don't trust their institutions anymore, and that's what I think is driving the extremism. And so from that premise, I detail a whole host of what I call disturbing public policy trends, a whole bunch of areas where, you know, we are going backwards, just some of those examples that I just cited. And again, these are just using the government's own numbers that we can clearly say that we are going backwards. And then I list a whole host of domestic and international scandals which have undermined confidence. You know, I mean, look, I was just listening to something the other day. I mean, this whole issue in England about Jimmy Savile, I mean, that is a big issue. I mean, he was engaged in pedophilia for decades, and it was covered up and protected by the BBC. And you know, a lot of people in England have completely lost confidence and trust in the BBC. And you know, whether it's a pedophilia in the UK or Jeffrey Epstein in terms of the US, or even some of our own situations in Australia with the Catholic Church and some other high profile people, you know, people have an expectation that if there is injustice, it would be addressed. And in a whole host of areas, that hasn't been addressed. So they're the basic elements of my submission. The last point I did talk in my submission about is typically you see violence in when a political system doesn't respond to people's concerns. And there's a whole host of factors that are leading people to feel like they're not being heard. So whether it's about being deplatformed, or whether you're being censored on social media, or whether you're being doxxed. For example, you potentially could lose your employment if you were to speak. I mean, it's very costly to go through the court system in Australia. And so with that, you know, I mean, the other thing I also cited is just the amount of new laws that the parliament is passing. I mean, it took me 16 months to defeat the $10,000 cash transaction ban, but that was only one law. And in that process, they were still passing, you know, tens of other laws that were pretty bad, but I just had the ability, I just had only the capacity to focus on one fight, and we won it. But it takes a lot of time and effort. And a lot of Australians are out there, you know, earning a living, trying to pay their mortgage with these unbelievable debts. And people don't have the time to do the research, to engage in Parliament, to actually go down to Canberra, sit down with the politicians and try to convince them that some of these laws are bad. So, you know, just the amount of stuff that the establishment is pushing out there, that makes it hard for people to have confidence that they can actually participate in democracy and actually make a difference. So they're the key elements. Now, I think that the inquiry really wants to focus on this Christchurch issue. Obviously, I think Labor's going to jump on what happened on the 6th of January and basically say that if we don't get on top of young white Australians talking radically, we could see a raid on Parliament, just like there was a raid on the US Congress, even though that was complete set up by the Democrats. But I've just tried to, rather than play their little Canberra game, I've said, okay, well, no, there's some really big issues about extremism and radicalization and violence that we need to bring to the table. So I've put together a 35-page submission. If I had the time and the resources, I definitely would have wanted to do more research and bring more things into my submission. But I think I've covered some of the main points, and we're just now waiting to see whether the submission will be accepted by the committee. And the other important point is that so in my submission, when I talk, for example, about cover up of elite pedophiles, I mean, I actually name names in my submission, but also and when I talk about a scandal, it's all hyperlinked. So I've found a whole bunch of mainstream media articles, whether it's about Jeffrey Epstein or a whole bunch of other people. And I've said, well, you know, I'm making this accusation that this is a scandal because it's already been acknowledged by the mainstream media. So all of it's hyperlinked. And so I guess one of the other things that I'll be looking at is, do they publish my submission unredacted, or do they start redacting parts of my submission because it makes people uncomfortable? And if they do redact certain scandals that I cite in my submission, I think that's going to be very, very telling about what the attitude of Parliament is about acknowledging the real problems that are facing not only this country, but a whole bunch of countries across the world.
Brilliant work, my friend. So what happens next for anybody that's listening and watching this? Mm-hmm. So you apply your submission, you submit your paper there. And yep. So if they don't accept it, or they do redactions, that's the right word, what's the process here moving forward?
Sure. So basically the process now is that the committee has to go through all the submissions, and then they obviously have to read them. Now from there, assuming my submission is, you know, assuming that the submission is accepted, the question then becomes is, do they have public hearings? So the committee has the right to have public hearings, and they have the right to call whatever witness they so choose. Now, I've already emailed the secretary and said that I want to testify. I had the opportunity to testify with the $10,000 cash transaction ban, and I had, I think, a reasonably powerful testimony. So if they have public hearings, they can call witnesses. I'm assuming ATO is going to be called. There'll be a whole bunch of other law enforcement organizations that are going to provide their two cents about some of these issues. And if I have the opportunity to testify, I will go to Canberra and testify. Now I should say they're not obligated to testify. I've seen inquiries where they just collect written submissions and they just go to a final report. The final report is due in April of this year, and that report will be delivered by the committee to the Minister for Home Affairs, which is Peter Dutton. So there was a bit of reporting in December by the mainstream media. The convention of Parliament is that you don't start to spread your submission until, particularly spreading it with the media, until it's accepted by the committee. So once it's accepted by the committee, my intention is to send my submission right across to a whole host of mainstream media journalists, and you know, obviously come on shows like yours and talk about it. And then obviously see if we can, you know, raise public attention about the issue, the inquiry, and some of the points I'm making. And then obviously if there's an opportunity to testify, I will. And then it's just really about what sort of final report does the committee put together, and what recommendations that they come up with. But I knowing how Canberra works, given that I used to work in federal parliament, I think what we can expect from this committee is four types of recommendations. One is, there'll be a recommendation to introduce new laws that have more criminal sanctions. And obviously that means that more activity is going to be prohibited by the federal government. The other, I think part two, what I'm expecting to see is more surveillance by ASIO. And they're basically going to say, well, we need to spy on more people. We need to have more power around spying, and basically who they want to spy on, people who express views that are anti-establishment. I think the third element is, and we're already starting to see this by the social media companies themselves, I think they're going to, you know, there'll be some sort of recommendation around cracking down on free speech in terms of social media. One of the big things I'm concerned about, and it's not completely transparent to my mind, is to what extent can either the federal government or the state government go to social media companies and shut down either groups or profiles, et cetera. I mean, when the stage four lockdown was happening in Victoria last year, I was getting the sense that certain groups or certain channels on YouTube or Facebook were being censored, at the request of the Victorian police. So obviously, if there's a crackdown on free speech on social media, I think that's very counterproductive. And the fourth element that I'm expecting to see is, so the government does have a few programs where they spend some, you know, maybe $50 million on what they call de-radicalization programs. So people who become extremist, whether it's about far-right extremism or Islamic extremism, there are counseling programs to basically, you know, make them less radical and to make them more mainstream so they can actually integrate back into mainstream society. So I think that's the four elements that I'm expecting to see from this committee. What does it basically mean? It means more laws. It means more surveillance, and it basically means less free speech. It means more spending of money that we don't have. And one of the points I made in my submission is those four sort of areas what I expect to see from the committee, they're just band-aid solutions. I mean, they're not actually addressing the root cause, which is there's a collapse in trust. So I've said, if you're serious about, you know, reducing extremism, if you want people to calm down on social media, the best thing to do is to reestablish trust with Parliament. And the only way you can do that is start doing the work of the people, rather than being obsessed with your sort of games in Canberra. Start to engage with the public about what the public wants Parliament to talk about, not what Parliament wants to talk about. And then hopefully by engaging a whole bunch of people across the political spectrum, people feel like they're getting heard, and also people feel like that their concerns about the country are actually being addressed by our politicians.
Are there good people in Canberra?
I don't mean Canberra.
I mean in government positions.
Well, okay. So what? One thing that I think unites the entire parliament is none of them have moral courage. I mean, think of the lion from The Wizard of Oz. So the scarecrow didn't have a brain. The Tin Man didn't have a heart, and the lion didn't have courage. I have seen politicians up close who were smart, who knew what was going on, but didn't have the guts to call it out. And there's some very good reasons why they won't call it out. And one is the pay. Most politicians are not rich. Most politicians come into parliament. So your base salary as a parliamentarian. So if you got elected, Pete, you'd be on about $200,000 a year. And that for someone who I know you've had a successful career, but most politicians are basically haven't done anything with their lives, and they come in and they're they're in the top 1% of income earners in Australia. So then if you get on some committees, you're going to get some extra money. If you become a chairman of a committee, your salary will probably, it'll bump up another $20,000-$30,000. If you get one of the formal roles in the parliament, if you become the speaker or the president in the Senate, or you become the acting or the deputy president, you get some more money there. If you're in government, if you're in the opposition, and you become a shadow minister or the leader of the opposition, your pay goes up. If you become the PM or the minister, your pay goes a lot higher. The PM is on about $500,000. Some of his cabinet ministers are on $400,000, and some of the junior ministers are on $350,000. These people have no chance of earning this sort of money in the private sector because they just don't have the entrepreneurial talent to be able to earn that money. Now, having said that, are there some wealthy people in Parliament who made their money before they came in? Yes, but I'd say that they're few and far between. So that's one element. The other element is this, what I call system of control. So, and the two major parties in particular, there is a machine that basically controls who gets to come into Parliament through the pre-selection process. And typically, if you are not a team player, so if you don't bow down to what the big wigs in the party or what the PM tells you, for example, if you're in the coalition, the first thing that they'll threaten you is with pre-selection. So if you don't toe the line, we're gonna get you out of Parliament by challenging you at the pre-selection. We'll basically stack the branches in your seat, and we'll find a way to get you out of Parliament. And those two elements, I think, are the most powerful elements which prevent people from actually doing what's right. One is, if they lose their job, they can't get the money, and the money is very good. And it's not just the money. You get free domestic travel. You get staff. You get invited to a whole bunch of fancy events, soirees, sporting events, corporate dinners. You get a lot of free stuff being a politician, and the lifestyle is pretty good. Compared to the average Aussie who's just, trying to battle away, pay the mortgage and try to raise the kids.
Well, as someone that was invited to the Logies every year, and I said, no, thank you. That doesn't interest that fucking doesn't interest me at all. I went once or twice about 15, 20 years ago, and I was like, there's no fucking way I want to be in that room ever again with those people. So I'm going to be good in this role, I think, because I'm not going to accept anything. And it's interesting what you're talking about there, accepting money, because even for a salary, and yes, I have made some wise choices in my life, but you look at someone like Donald Trump who didn't accept his salary, who donated it. There's something interesting in that, and there's something very profound in that. And I think that's why he has had so much support, because why would somebody like that go into politics? And it's very, very interesting for me. And sorry to interrupt you there, but I'm loving this conversation because I'm learning a lot about the inner workings of it. I know you're on a roll here, so please keep going, but I want you to step up the ladder for me. How does the Prime Minister get elected? How does a person step up the ranks? I mean, we've had 7 Prime Ministers in the last 10 years or something stupid, which again has dissolved the trust in this system, because it just seems absurd that we've had, I think we've probably had the most prime ministers in any Western country over the short period of time. But how does somebody keep going up and up the ranks here in their political parties?
Sure. Okay. So, what I would say is probably slightly different in terms of Victoria. In terms of the ALP versus the coalition. But in terms of the coalition, you look at the last. I'm just trying to think that over the last four prime ministers from the coalition. Common thing, they're all from New South Wales. So John Howard, Abbott, Turnbull, Morrison, they're all from New South Wales. So now Robert Menzies, who started the Liberal Party, is from Victoria. And there have been some Victorian leaders, but mainly it is New South Wales. Whereas with Labor, for example, Bill Shorten was from Victoria. Albanese is from New South Wales. Gillard was Victoria. Rudd was Queensland. Labor is a little bit more different, but the coalition tends to be very dominating in terms of New South Wales. You know, that's where the leader comes from. So the first thing is that if you want to be the leader of the Liberal Party in the federal parliament, if you're from New South Wales, you have a much higher chance of getting there compared to if you're from another part of the country. So obviously the other thing is that when you look at those four people that I just cited with in terms of Howard, Abbott, Turnbull, Morrison, they're all from Sydney. So these people who come to Sydney have deep connections into the media, into a whole bunch of cultural institutions. They have a huge amount of linkages into the banks, and they have a huge like a big number of backers. And I would say that Sydney politics and the various factions within Sydney, not just politically but in the corporate world, they have a huge influence as to how the game is played in terms of Canberra. So there is a power structure within that's within, for example, the Liberal Party that's outside of Parliament that has a huge role in trying to promote certain people. And the media, if the establishment, for example, if the Sydney banking establishment didn't want a particular candidate because they were anti-bank, for example, their friends in the media would start to run a whole bunch of negative press that would turn the public to thinking that this person was not going to be a good leader. So having broad stakeholder support across the Sydney establishment, or in some cases the Melbourne establishment, I think that's quite important. The other thing that tends to happen is that when you get into Parliament, the first thing you try to do is you want to get onto the front bench, and then you want to work your way through. You want to work your way through the ranks. A lot of people try to get good press. They try to raise their profile, and by doing so, you have to play the dance that the mainstream media wants you to play, and you've got to do the things and say the things that the mainstream media wants you to play. And obviously, if you try to be too controversial, that's going to play a negative role. So there are probably a couple of the key things. Now, once you sort of get into the minister role, or you become into in the cabinet, Then you play a slightly different game, and the different game is that you start to try to take charge of your party, and you try to control who comes into Parliament. So let me give you an example. So Barnaby Joyce came in 2007, and so we're here in 2021. He came in 2004, Barnaby Joyce, when he first got elected to the Senate. Because in the first 3 years he caused John Howard grief because he kept on voting. He voted against Howard 26 times in the Senate. So from 2004 to 2021, Barnaby Joyce has been in Parliament. Now, in that time, he has had the opportunity to have a number of national MPs and senators be elected who used to work for him. Matt Canavan, who's a senator from Queensland, he was in the cabinet. He was the mining minister for a while before he quit. He was the former chief of staff for Barnaby Joyce when I was working for Senator Dennis in 2012-13. So when you can bring people in who either have loyalty to a certain individual, or who have served in a lot of these MPs have served in have already been staffers. So whereas back in say the 50s and 60s, political parties would try to draw widely from the community. So Labor would have union leaders, they would have teachers, they would have farmers, they would have a whole bunch of working class people come into Parliament, the cream, what Frank Crean used to say, the cream of the cream. Now you have a whole bunch of union hacks and a whole bunch of lawyers who all they do since they get into university is they play politics. And that is to a certain extent what the Liberal Party has done as well. So so a lot of these people have deep relationships. They play a whole bunch of games, and they try to get their own people into Parliament so that when it comes to a leadership battle. So, for example, when Morrison challenged Turnbull for the leadership, even though it appeared that he wasn't behind it, he was absolutely behind it. But Morrison was able to rely on a whole bunch of people who were loyal to him, because he helped a number of these people get into Parliament. And that's the obviously part of the game. So you get in, you rise up, you bring your own people into Parliament, and then when it comes to the ultimate leadership vote, you have the numbers, and then you become the leader, whether you're becoming the Prime Minister or the leader of the opposition. And because these people, sorry, I just want to make this point, because these people are loyal to, all to each other, and because it is a cesspool of people who just want to leech on the taxpayer and get these exorbitant salaries, no one's actually going to advocate for the right policies. One is that they're not intellectually capable of actually thinking through some of these things. But on the other hand, if they turn against their own tribe, well, their own tribe will basically throw them out, and then they just have to go out there and try to earn a living and raise a family, trying to do it the honest way. And a lot of these people either don't have the time or the skills to actually be able to do that. I mean, for example, I can't remember. Look, I think it was Ricky Muir. Ricky Muir, I think, was from Victoria. He got elected to the Senate. I think he was on a very low income, maybe $30,000 a year, just being a wood chipper or something like that. And from basically cutting down trees to being on $200,000 a year with staff and being in the media all the time, etc. It's a very big change. So for politicians who are in a lot of money with a lot of power, and people want to talk to them all the time, to basically being ignored, and your income is slashed, and then you have to actually go get a job. That's a very tough thing to do. And because of all of those forces, people just say, well, I just need to keep my mouth shut and do what the system wants me to do. Otherwise, my life is going to be very different to the counterfactual.
I'm struggling with the notion that these people aren't entrepreneurs, and that the media, you mentioned it before, that the media seems to have such a huge power in the outcome of the electoral process. So without being a conspiracy theorist, how does that work then? Because if these people aren't that intelligent, like you're saying, then how can they run a country properly? Because the thing that really astounds me is when you see a minister, for instance, Minister for Health, once was the Minister for Agriculture or the Minister for Education. It's like, how can these people be rotating through this? It's like musical chairs. How can they be experts in their chosen field? Explain that, because that baffles me. It's like, am I the only one that sees this issue of... I can't use any other word but fucking insanity.
Yeah, sure. So technically, the minister is not supposed to be, they're not supposed to be the expert. I mean, they're supposed to lead. If you say what's the role of the minister, it is to lead in their portfolio. So they have to rely on their department. They have to rely on a whole bunch of independent experts, and they have to make the appropriate sort of choices and decisions for the country. Now, obviously, if you are an expert in a certain area, that obviously helps. But being an expert, I mean, here's the thing. So no matter what sort of professional field you go into, whether it's being a professional economist or being a professional engineer or an accountant or a lawyer, you have to get certain qualifications. You have to sit for certain certifications. You have to have certain levels of expertise before you can actually practice in your field. Politics, Parliament is the only field in the country where you don't have to have any qualifications.
Sorry, I have to laugh at that because I'm entering that. And it's awesome. But what you're saying is it's ridiculous, basically.
Sure. Now, one of the things you just asked was how can they lead? Well, I argue they're not leading. I mean, because just like I said earlier in this conversation, in a whole host of metrics, the country's going backwards. They keep on saying we're the best country in the world. And I have to say, this is something that John Howard started, I think, in 2006, 2007 at the end of his government, where he said that he loves Australia because we're the greatest in the world. And ever since then, politicians just keep on pushing this out, trying to say, because Australians like to hear it. A lot of Australians want to hear that we're the best in the world. But when you look at the statistics, we've collapsed in many ways in the last 20 years, and no one actually wants to. Here's the thing. I'm not here to necessarily endorse Donald Trump, but because he was independently wealthy and he didn't politics was his chosen profession, he had the capacity to go above the media and actually tell people what he really thought. And that would be refreshing if we did have someone who would be willing to look straight into the camera and say to the country, we've got some big problems. These problems have been building up over 20, 30 years. And it's going to take a lot of pain, a lot of heartache to actually fix these problems and get to a better place. But we actually have to start, we actually have to acknowledge that we're going backwards.
Mm. So who is leading? Is it, because you mentioned before, the media has a part to play in this. So who's leading this? Is it the institutions? Is it the pharmaceutical? Is it the lobbyists? How does that work?
So there's a whole bunch of corporate interests that are just basically trying to set the agenda. And typically these politicians that they are the ones that just go along for the ride. Now, you asked earlier about the role of the media. So I just want to give you one example. So, even though I disagree with Gillard on a lot of things, one thing I'll give her credit for is if you pick up her autobiography, she had one chapter about Peter Hatcher. Now, Peter Hatcher is a journalist for Fairfax who wrote basically so many articles which was anti-Gillard and pro-Rudd, and all of his articles were wrong. They were completely misstating the facts, and they kept on relying on anonymous sources. Now, the anonymous source was obviously Rudd, but he never mentioned that. But for example, he would say there is such destabilization in the Gillard government that a challenge may happen in the next 2 weeks. Well, 2 weeks would finish and nothing would happen. And Gillard actually, documented all of these false reporting by Peter Hatcher. Now, when I worked in federal parliament, I was told by people in the coalition that Peter Hatcher was on a jihad to remove Gillard and to install Rudd. Now, for me, it's up to the public as to who they want their prime minister to be. It's not up for individual journalists to say, I'm going to remove the prime minister and I'm going to put in the prime minister who I want. But that is the attitude that some politicians, that some journalists have in the press gallery, that they think they have the power to remove the prime minister and to put a new leader in. Now, the question I have about Peter Hatcher is who gave him the order? Was it his own initiative? One would say that I don't think so, because I don't think his editors at Fairfax would allow him to push to publish consistently false reports about Gillard in order to put Rudd in. So someone at Fairfax gave the order to Hatcher. Okay, we want you to remove Gillard. We want you to put Rudd back in, and so go to work. And I've heard of other instances, for example. Someone who I know's daughter was working at Fairfax, Sydney Morning Herald, in I think 2014-15. And when they would walk into the newsroom in the morning, the journalists weren't asking, well, what is the truth today and how do we report the truth to the public? The attitude was, we want to get rid of Abbott. What dirt can we find about Abbott today and how do we publish it? So there is clearly an agenda in the newsroom. There is a sense of entitlement that they have the ability to dictate what politicians do, what they say, and who and which politicians will be in which spot. And part of that power comes from the reliance on Australians to watch TV. So I think we may have said in the last show, one of the best pieces of advice people can have to free your mind is turn off the TV, because it's tightly controlled, systematic propaganda, whereas at least on the internet or platforms like this, you have the chance to pick and choose who you want to listen to. Whereas with Australian TV, there is no opportunity for counter narratives, whether about politics or vaccines or whatever the case may be. So, the power of the media is because people consume it and they're not willing to ignore it. And that power is then used to implement a whole bunch of political agendas that the media want.
Let me ask you a question. The kookaburras are laughing outside because they think it's hilarious about the media, but it's also frightening at the same time. So let's just take Kevin Rudd, for instance. From my understanding, he has an issue with Murdoch, which is the other media behemoth that wanted him out. So if we've got Fairfax wanting Gillard out, we've got Murdoch potentially wanting Rudd out, and we've seen that also with Turnbull. Is it just two media players that have an agenda, and are they fighting against each other, or is that too simple a view?
So I do think it's a little bit more complex, because the ABC absolutely have their own agenda, and they have gone after certain individuals as well. Now the question I haven't been able to figure out, because I don't rub shoulders with it in terms of these circles, is to what extent are global players influencing some of these domestic players? So is there a global agenda driving some of these things that we can see in Australia? Or is it just because of certain individuals in certain positions of power? For example, did Rupert Murdoch one day wake up and say, I don't like Turnbull, I want him gone? Or did someone at Fairfax wake up one day and say, I don't like Gillard, I want her gone? So is it just a bunch of people who think they're powerful in Australia and they just think, okay, I'm going to do what I want to do? Or is there a more nefarious international network of people that are influencing what happens in Australia? Now, to some extent, there is some global influencing. It happens through intelligence services. It happens through the Five Eyes, MI5, MI6, CIA. I think historically, intelligence services, even including, for example, there are speculation about how and why Whitlam was dismissed in 1975. So I think that definitely has a role to play. The other thing I think has a huge influence about how some of these people in Australia behave is what happens in the palace. So the Queen and the royal family and the British establishment. So London still does have a lot of sway in certain circles with certain people in this country. And that, I think, is not fully transparent to the public as to how does that really manifest itself. So obviously we have the Governor General, that's the Queen's representative, but to what extent is the Queen providing instructions or orders to the Governor General or to the Prime Minister? And not just the Queen herself, but the other members of the royal family, and what linkages do they have right across the country? So there is no doubt that various media organisations or cultural institutions, politicians, etc., have some affinity or have some relationship with people in London. And I'm still scratching my head as to how that all works. Now, obviously, when you think about George Papadopoulos and his sort of ordeal in the Russia hoax, he basically said that Alexander Downer, in his capacity as the High Commissioner for Australia in London, was working in concert with MI6 to basically set up a trap for Donald Trump. So there is, I think, some former ministers, maybe some current ministers who have linkages with intelligence services and other organisations in London and across England. But how that really works, I don't think anyone has really gone to the detail of saying, well, who's giving what order? Because I think a lot of this is still very concealed. I think there's a mix of, there are some domestic people who just think they're so important that they're going to actually dictate what happens in politics. And I do think there are some international organizations, and even things like the United Nations or the IMF or the Bank for International Settlements has enormous power in this country when you look at the decisions of the Reserve Bank of Australia in terms of APRA, in terms of monetary policy, in terms of what the banks have. So there's a whole host of powerful forces that dictate what people do in this country, but no one's gone to the level of detail to actually understand how that fully works on a day-to-day basis.
To finish this off, 55 minutes, 55 seconds is good. I just looked at the time. Always a good sign when the numbers align. So my final question for you for round two. Is it possible to steer the ship away from the impending doom and catastrophe that we see happening? In your opinion?
Well,
can one person make a difference? Can one political party make a difference? Can Australians stand up and unite and make a difference?
The shorter answer is that we don't know, because Australians haven't tried. I think to a great extent, we have been complacent. Like, I'm talking about the average Aussie. The average Aussie has been complacent. They haven't actually got involved. For example, I mean, when we started this campaign about the $10,000 cash ban, there was me and a group of people on the internet who started making a bunch of videos, and we started to get the word out there, and then we started telling people to write in submissions and actually participate in the process. Now, at the time, a lot of people didn't think that it would make any difference. People just thought that the system was, dead set against banning cash, and there was nothing that we can do. One of the benefits of that process, that this grassroots campaign that we led, was a whole bunch, thousands of Australians across the country contacted politicians for the first time. So I got messages all the time to say that I never contacted my local senator or my local MP. But I decided to, because this was such an important issue. And people, to be honest, felt slightly intimidated about engaging with their local politician. But once they've done that and they realize that these politicians are just ordinary people with a big title and a big salary, people feel more comfortable to actually confront their local politician and actually tell them what they say. So, you know, we had, a few thousand people be actively engaged in that campaign, and we did make a difference. Now, that was one law. So the question really is, you know, if millions of people across the country, whether it's through a new political party or whether through the existing structure, whether they actually sort of stood up and said, well, enough is enough, we want the country to move in a different direction, could we? Part of me would hope that we can. But I think it just remains to be seen. I think the main thing is that people need to get involved. People need to, sitting down on the couch and watching garbage TV. I think they just need to stop that and think, well, I'll give you a classic example. I mean, when I was doing this cash ban transaction and I was talking to my mum was saying, Why are you getting involved in this stuff? Leave that up to the politicians. I mean, that is their job. And I said to the mum, I used to work in the building. I know these people, they're a bunch of idiots. I don't trust them. I don't trust them that they're going to actually produce a better Australia for my kids. So because I have had that firsthand experience and I know the caliber of the people I'm dealing with, people just need to not be intimidated, get involved, in the issues. If we can, work in a cohesive and in a collaborative manner across the country, I think we can bend the system to a certain extent, but how far, the future is yet to be written.
John, brother, you have a very important role to play in all of this. I know it. I can feel it in my heart, and I really appreciate my dog is agreeing that sentiment at the moment. Love you, brother, and I really appreciate the time that you've taken to share your wisdom and your perspective on the current situation and climate in Australia. And it's time for change. That's all I can say. Well done, brother.
Fantastic. Thanks, mate.